name's Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. I also used to be a Pentecostal preacher, and you just put a microphone in front of me. It's going to get fun. No, I'm really not kidding. I was. My sobriety date is April 7, 2016. That was the day that I was separated from my obsession for alcohol. And it's a day that, if I do this right, I'll always remember as the greatest day of my life. Getting there wasn't so great. And I'm going to share that a little bit with you guys. You know, our story is disclosed in a general way, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm going to be pretty specific about some stuff that happened, what it used to be like and what it's like now. You know, the big book says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I also, for 20 years, took handfuls of Norcos and Somas and anything else I could get my hands on, because I like the effect produced by anything, as long as it changes the way I feel about myself. But when I first saw that statement in the big book, I was in treatment in Austin, and I read that. I said, okay, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I literally wrote in my big book, duh, because I did. And I didn't know there was another reason to drink. And it goes on to talk about how we're restless, irritable, and discontent unless we can again experience the ease and comfort that comes with taking a few drinks. And I remember the first time that that alcohol worked for me, the first time I felt that ease and comfort. I was about 8 years old, and I was at a wedding with my parents. Now, I grew up with an alcoholic. Okay, the big book says don't call anyone an alcoholic. My dad wore the uniform. It was on occasion. On occasion, there were frozen turkeys at Thanksgiving that flew through plate glass windows. I can remember digging the Christmas tree out of a dumpster one year because, I don't know, Dad would get drunk, and that seemed to be how we celebrated the holidays. And, you know, growing up in that house, I used to blame a lot on that. But we were at this wedding, and I remember seeing my mom had a drink. And I freaked out, like completely lost my mind. I don't know why, maybe because I was worried she'd be like that, I don't know, but I just lost it. And so they were trying to console me and eventually got my mom over there to me. And when I told her, I had the hup-ups, so I was like, I don't know. And so the answer to fix this inconsolable child was, hey, well, here, I'll pour you your own drink. And it was Black Velvet whiskey and Pepsi. Now, I didn't get drunk, but I do remember taking that sip or the first sip of that, and something magical happened on the inside. Everything was okay. I just knew all of a sudden everything was okay. And a matter of fact, that night on the way home, my dad and I got into a great conversation, one of just a few times I can count on one finger that my dad ever told me he loved me. I'm not trashing my dad. It's just he wasn't that kind of person. But that night, as we were driving home, we had this great conversation, and little fat 8-year-old me jumped out of the car at the end and ran around and threw my arms around my dad and said, I love you. And my dad promptly went and locked himself in the bathroom for 3 hours, and I didn't know what I did wrong. Eventually, my mom said, I didn't do anything wrong. My dad just didn't know how to respond to that. You know, I grew up in a home. I was raised Catholic and Mormon at the same time. That was interesting. So my dad was Mormon, obviously not a good one because they don't drink, but my dad was Mormon, my mom was Catholic. So all growing up, for me, it looked like this. On Saturday nights, we would go with my mom, my aunts, and my grandmother to Mass, and on Sunday mornings, we went to the temple. Tabernacle, whatever you want to call it, at the Mormon church. And so I grew up kind of stretched between these. You can't get further apart. I'm sorry, you just can't. I don't know if there's any Catholics or Mormons here, but, you know, we can either do Hail Marys or talk about, never mind, I won't get into that. So I grew up like that. I can actually remember in the 80s, you know, growing up in Austin, Austin was a lot different. Anybody here from California? I blame all of you. Honestly, when I sobered up, you know, we were talking about resentments, and I told my sponsor I had resentments against California's Californians because they ruined Austin. And he, like, after hearing that for, I don't know, the 50th time, he said, you're probably just going to need to get over that. So I'm working on it. So progress, not perfection, right? No, but growing up in Austin was a lot different in the 80s, especially back when the drinking age was 18. I was 6 foot tall and 196 pounds as a 13-year-old. We could get into bars. You know, and what we would do is go to 6th Street and look for the drunkest bouncer and make friends with him, and eventually he'd let us in. Or, you know, I had buddies, I could put on a cowboy hat, pull it down low, put on a blue jean jacket, just walk into a store, grab some 12-packs, throw them up, act like I knew what I was doing, and I was off. So by the time I was 14, I had a whole experience with drinking. I remember waking up in the turn lane of North Lamar one night from a blackout. I was just where Lamar and Peyton Jen intersect. I woke up in the turn. I wasn't in a car. I just woke up in the turn lane with all of my friends on the sidewalk going, Jeff, Jeff. I successfully kept an entire party of stoners that were a lot older than me. We got to this house. They were all waiting for the guy with the weed. I didn't do weed because weed was for nasty drug addicts back then. And so while they were waiting, they said, well, there's booze there, help yourself. And by the time the guy with the weed got there, I was so drunk they didn't smoke because they had to take care of me. So I don't know whether to be proud of that or if it was just a sign of things to come. When I was 14, I met this little girl in eighth grade, and we were friends. And when I turned 14, she became my girlfriend, and she's real pretty. I mean, like I said earlier, I grew up a little fat kid, and then I got to be a big fat kid. But for a little while there, I was working out playing football in the Texas heat, so I got into pretty good shape. She actually did say that she used to like the way I looked in my football pants, which I'll take that at my age now, you know. Trust me, I don't put on football pants anymore. But I started dating this little girl, and at 14, she was telling me and begging me not to go out with my friends because I would go out and drink. And you know, my first drunk was actually at 11, my first drink at 8, my first drunk at 11. But by the time I'm 14, it's out of control. But I wouldn't do drugs because that's what drug addicts do. And that's what my brother did. So, and actually coming up with my brother, I don't usually share this, but, you know, my brother's done everything from A to Z, and that made life a lot easier for me. And he's a year younger. But the attention was always focused on him, and I got away with murder because of it. So that was always a good thing. I think Big Book talks about manipulation somewhere, and I use that to the hilt. But this little girl would beg me, no, don't go out with your friends, don't go out with your friends, and I would. And I always inevitably would end up drunk. And so it got to the point where I was depressed. I stopped going to school, I faked a suicide because I'm a dramatic alcoholic. I didn't have the guts to do it, but I pretended and wrote the letter and everything. My mom found me. I played up the whole thing. That really sucked when the EMTs got there because they made me drink liquid charcoal. Almost made me wish I had taken the damn pills. I just turned into a sieve. Everything that was in me was coming out. And, you know, we played that up. I had to go to see counselors and all that. I was depressed. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, I just didn't have the guts to really take all those pills. But about that time, that little girl, she had grown up in a Pentecostal church. And, yeah, Jesus on calisthenics, y'all. And so she didn't know what to do with me. And so she decided to go to church and hope I would follow. And I did because she's real pretty. And so I would go to church with this little girl. And I would do what all the cool kids do. I'd sit on the back row. And the first time I walked into a Pentecostal church, now I grew up Catholic and Mormon, like you can't get any further apart unless you become Pentecostal. So I've got all these weird spiritual ideas, and I'm sitting on the back row, and at the end of every service, they would always give an altar call. And in that church, they had these old wooden benches in the front. And at the end of the service, the men would go one way and the women would go the other because that's how Pentecostals do it. And there were these two guys, Dylan and John were their names. And every service, they would come back to me on the back row and they'd say, brother, will you come forward with us and pray? And I'd say, no. And after a few times that, they finally said, well, how about would you kneel down here and pray? And I finally agreed to that. So I would get down and I'd get on my knees and I'd say, God, get me the hell out of here. And, but I kept going because, again, I cannot stress, she was really pretty. And I kept going. And finally, one night, I don't know what you want to call it. I had a vision. I saw something. I saw it. It was real to me. Preacher was up there preaching, and I had this experience. And at the end of that service, nobody had to come get me. I got up and I marched my big rear end down there, and I got on that wooden altar and I cried a puddle of snot and tears. And I stood up, and they were all people standing around me going, "Praise the Lord, brother. Everything's going to get great." And I felt good, right? I felt good. And 2 weeks later, I broke up with that little girl. I'm sitting in a hot tub in North Austin with a 46-year-old woman. I'm 15 by this time. I'm sitting in this hot tub with this 46-year-old woman, and I'm hitting on her, and I am drunk. And, ladies, you're going to love this. My big closing line with this woman. Well, let me back up. So in the course of conversation, I found out she knew my mom. Like, I mean, no, they worked right next door to each other. So she knew my mom by name. And so my big line to close this deal was I looked at her and I said, "Hey, if you don't like it, you can always tell my mom." Yeah, so needless to say, nothing happened that night. So, but I tell you all of that part to tell you that I had a spiritual experience. I tell you that part because not only did I have a spiritual experience, but a little while later, I went back to that pretty little girl. I went back to that church. And what I had done, in essence, was I set up a pattern that continued for the next 30 years of my life. I would go and I would have these experiences. I would try to get things right. Unfortunately, my story plays a part with other women involved. And I would just do this over and over. And I could never seem to get it right. I was having spiritual experiences, but couldn't stay sober. And so you fast forward. Now, when we started dating originally, about 3 months into that, I told that little girl, I said, "I'm going to marry you someday." And she laughed at me. And what she should have done is run the other direction and said no and never spoke to me again. But 5 years later, we did get married. As a matter of fact, the day after our wedding, and we woke up and I said, "I told you." And she goes, "Told me what?" I said, "I told you 5 years ago I was going to marry him." And she said, "Jeffrey, you're crazy." And she always says, "Jeffrey, you're crazy." She's been saying it for almost, 32 years now. Not always for the same reasons, but Jeffrey is a little crazy. She has put up with more than any woman should. I'll say this. My wife has a tremendous capacity for faith, unlike anybody I've ever seen. And someday I aspire to be like her. But so what's important to note here. Now, again, I told you I grew up. I was kind of the fat kid. I was self-deprecating all the time. You know, before you could say something to make fun of me, I would do it. But I always wanted to be with a real pretty girl, and I got that. It was like a dream to be with a pretty girl, and I did it. I did it. And thank you. Thank you. You get it. So I got a dream, you know. One of my dreams has come true. And then I wanted to marry her, and I got that. I wanted to be a drummer. Again, growing up with my dad, we moved a lot because my dad had this tendency to get drunk and call whatever boss he had and tell him to go fuck himself and quit his job. And then go, "Hey, we're moving to wherever." And so I remember in grade school, I was about to start taking drum lessons and we had to move. And so, I was going to this Pentecostal church. They said, "Hey, we want all the youth to sing." All the youth. It was me and three girls. And so I sang the guy part, and immediately after, the associate pastor came and said, "You want to play drums, right?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he goes, "Good, because you can sing back here as loud as you want. Nobody's going to hear you." And so I started playing drums, another dream come true. I got the girl, I married her, I'm playing drums. I wanted to have children. I wanted to be the kind of dad that my dad wasn't. Our first child came in 1995. I can still remember when my wife came home to tell me that she was pregnant. Y'all ever see the old show, The Jeffersons? There's that scene where George is dancing on the bed. And my hand to God, and she'll tell you if I'm lying, I worked nights at the time, and she told me she was pregnant, and I jumped up, started dancing on the bed. And to me, pregnancies only take 6 months, because that's, we usually found out when she was 3 months pregnant. But we had my daughter, and y'all, my daughter, she's 24 now. But I can tell you, for the first time in my life, I knew what love was when we brought her home and I held that little girl in my arms. You know, my wife said, "Here, hold the baby." And I said, "Sure." And I had, you know, held her in the hospital, but now we're at home and I'm holding this child against my chest and she falls asleep. And so I don't want to move. I don't want to disturb this. Like, I'm having a spiritual moment here. And I'm not kidding. So I kind of got myself on the couch and I laid back on that couch for a couple hours. I was barely moving and I was just listening and watching this baby breathe in and out. And I made a vow that day. I didn't say it out loud, but I did. I said, if anybody ever hurts this child, I'll kill him. And I meant it. And about 15 months later, Mini-Me showed up. He was a bouncing baby boy. It's funny, after my daughter was born, I looked at my wife and I said, "You want to have another one?" She said, "Yeah." My daughter was like 6 pounds, 15 ounces. 15 months later, my son is born 9 pounds, 1 ounce. I said, "You want to have another one?" She goes, "Nope, I'm done. I'm done." So, Mini-Me is now, he'll be 23 this month, June, or coming up in June. Mini-Me is 6'4" now. So I have the wife, I have the kids, I'm playing drums. All my dreams are coming true. I wanted to be in a band. I got to be in a couple of little bands, nothing major, nobody you've ever heard of, but we did get to play around different places. I wanted to be paid to play drums. I made a whopping $40. I'm a pro. I got paid. Dreams are just coming true. You know, I had this dream at about 17. I felt called to ministry. And, I can remember it was in 1996 after my son was born. Or right before my son was born, they came and from the church I was at and they said, "Hey, are you ready to go to work?" Cause I was on, this is kind of important in my story. So in 96, I donated a kidney to my sister cause she needed one better, more than I had two and she needed one. Cool. So they told me two things at that point. They said, "You can't drink and you can't take a lot of like acetaminophen and all that kind of stuff." So yeah, for the next 20 years, I proceeded to try to pickle the one kidney and took so much Norco every day I'd get full. They called me while I was recovering from that. I said, "Do you want to go to work?" And I said, "Well, I got a couple more weeks on my thing." He goes, "No, I'm not talking about your job." And they made me the youth pastor, of that church. And boom, man, another dream is coming true. I was a youth pastor for 17 years. I was volunteer for about 12 of those years. At one point, I wanted to be paid. That was like a dream of mine. I want to get paid to do ministry. And in 2003, that happened. I got to go work at a church down in south of Austin and was in the ministry for 5 years there. Now, between 96 and 2016, I can't stay sober. And I'm taking way too many pills. I hurt my back. I've had 4 back surgeries. I've had 4 knee surgeries. They'll give me whatever I ask for pretty much. But I'm taking them at an alarming rate. And I'm going off on binges and drinking. See, I thought when I got to rehab, I thought I had all this sober time. Until my wife so lovingly pointed out, "No, remember you did this and this and this." So I would go off on these binges. So as I'm standing before you right now, I have 3 years a month and like 2 weeks. It's the longest I've been sober since I was 11 years old. Now, do the math. I was a preacher for 17 years. I was a drunk preacher. I'm not proud of that fact, but yes, there were times I actually stood in the pulpit, either pilled up out of my head or too drunk, but I did it. You know, that's my story. And I can't stay sober. So I have all these dreams coming true. The big book says that we're restless, irritable, and discontent unless we can again experience the ease and comfort that comes with taking a few drinks. So I know not everybody gets to live their dreams, right? But I'm standing here to tell you tonight that I've lived my dreams and every one of them left me restless, irritable, and discontent. And the only thing that would fix it was the same thing that fixed it at that wedding when I was 8 years old. I need a drink. Problem is, the drink stopped working long before I realized it did. As a matter of fact, we were talking about this at a meeting in my sponsor's house just before this. So one night we went out with some friends and one of the guys ordered a glass of wine. You know, the big book says, we won't pronounce you an alcoholic, but you can diagnose yourself. Go try some controlled drinking. And so we went out this one night, and one of the guys ordered a glass of wine. I said, oh, that sounds good. So I ordered a glass of wine and a glass of tea. And I drank a glass of wine, and the rest of the night I drank a glass of tea. So every time my wife would say, you have a drinking problem, I would say, no, I don't. I can stop anytime I want. Remember, I had that glass of wine, and that's all I had. The problem is we were having that conversation in 2016. That night happened in 1997. And so I was a little resentful that I only had to drink one because I remembered it 20 years later and she didn't. All right, that went over some of y'all's heads, but okay. So I'm getting all my dreams come true. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I wanted to be ordained in ministry. And finally, that's going to happen. So I've lived all my dreams. Everything's coming true for me. And it's the day of my ordination. And I'm standing on a platform in front of a couple hundred people. My parents are in the audience. My wife's there. My kids are there. And these guys are all going to, you know, kind of commission me. And it should have been the culmination of my life's work. And I am standing on that stage, and I cannot lift my head up and look at anybody in the audience because I know what I was doing just the night before. All my dreams are coming true. And I'm still restless, irritable, and discontent. And I'm still acting out, and I'm still doing things. I'm still trying to change something internally that I'm starting to think I'm a mental defective at this point in my life. You know, I decided in late 2010, early 2011, my wife decided that I needed to go talk to somebody. And so I started going to see a psychiatrist. And I didn't want to go to a Christian psychiatrist because this is about the same time I decided that that whole faith thing and everything that I was doing in my life, that's for the birds. There is no God. In 2008, I had to quit my dream job because I was taking so many pills, I was worried I'd really end up killing myself. And I hated this job anyway. And that's kind of how we are. I took this job because it was the fulfillment of a dream. And within, a year, 2 years? I hate it. I hate everything about it. But I'm still there. And I'm having back surgeries and I'm getting more pills and I'm getting more restless, irritable, and discontent. And finally I quit that job and came to Kyle, and then I go to see this shrink. I don't want a Christian psychiatrist because I don't really believe there's a God. I'll tell you I do. And in all honesty, I did it because I knew that my wife would be upset. I still went to church because they let me play drums and I dug that, but I was pursuing atheism hardcore. So I would go, and this guy was an ex-Marine. And so after about the second or third time that I met with him, this is how our sessions would start. I'd walk in, say hi, sit down, and he'd look at me and go, so what'd you fuck up this time? Verbatim, that's how it would go. And I would launch off into a dialect of what I had done the previous 7 days. And at the end of about 3 years of seeing this guy, his official medical diagnosis was that, Jeff, you crave chaos. Because of how you were born, you crave chaos. And if there's no chaos going on in your life, you're going to create it. Cool. How do you fix that? Oh, you don't. I take that back. You go to Walmart and you buy one item and you get in the longest line. And then you try not to kill everybody in the store. So I did it, and I didn't kill anybody in the store. But in my mind, everybody's dead. I have to remember, my wife tells me sometimes, she goes, you have this look where it looks like you could kill everybody in the room. And I forget, for a while there, that look was just all the time. So I crave chaos. And he sends me on my way. What he did was he gave me a blank check to keep drinking. You know, my kids, by 2016, my daughter's graduated high school. She's in college. My son's graduated high school. And he's moved out. Now, I didn't throw turkeys through plate glass windows, and I didn't drag Christmas trees in the trash. But I did pass out in my yard and the neighbor's yard, and I would wake up not knowing where I was or how I got back in my house in different clothes. I made a fool of myself and my sister-in-law as well. I did drunk guy stuff, right? Or, you know, when I was pilled up. I think it was Robin Williams who said if they made a pill that would cure alcoholism, if you took just one, the alcoholic would look at it and go, I wonder what two of those would do. And that's kind of how I took pills too. So, you know, just after growing, see, they grew up with Pastor Jeff outside of the house and this raving lunatic guy taking way too many pills and drinking in the house. So by 2016, my son is done. Like, he hates me. And my daughter is just not having anything to do with me. And my wife is finally at that point where she's going to leave. Now, I don't know that part. I know my kids hate me because that's all I talk about when I'm drunk. My kids hate me. And can't have another drink, Jeff. That's going to fix it. But I don't know that she's going to leave. Now, that's significant because 2016 in August was when she had planned to leave because that's when our lease was up. August 10th of 2016 was my 25th wedding anniversary. So I almost got divorced for my wedding anniversary. Had she told me that she was going to leave unless I got help, I probably would have gone to got help just for that reason. I didn't find any of this out until after I had gone to get help. So it gets to the point where I'm there. It's me and my wife and my daughter. My son won't have anything to do with me. I scare my daughter. I'm picking her up at college and driving her and stuff, and I'm doing it constantly drunk. And we finally get to a point, we get in this argument, we get home, and she is so afraid of me, she barricades herself in her room, like desk, chairs, anything. I just found out recently there was a few times that she went out the window while I was drunk because she didn't want to be around that. Now, remember, I told you when we brought her home and I had her on the couch, I made a vow to kill anybody that ever hurt that child. And you fast forward that, and the one person that's hurt her the most is me. And my son won't talk to me. I got no friends. I got two people that'll still answer the phone. And I'm still finding out stories to this day of stuff that I did and said. My standard answer to things now is, do you remember when? I go, look, I used to drink a whole lot. My memory's kind of shot for a while. But I'm still finding out about phone calls I made and things I said. And I literally told one of my buddies, he was actually in my youth group at one point. We became friends. And he just told me the other day, yeah, he used to call me and just be like, yeah, I'd say something about prayer or God, and he'd just be like, fuck God, fuck you. And he'd go, okay, Jeff. And, you know, he was getting to the point he didn't want to hear from me anymore either, and I'm doing this. And so that night, my daughter has barricaded herself in her room. My son had to come and get her. She called him. I remember, the only thing I remember about that night, so she's in her room, I guess, and I was kicking the door, I think, and I was asking her to come out and talk to me about what I have no idea. Now, this part I remember because she called her brother from his house. So the door flings open, and it's like an old Western where the hero walks into the saloon, the sunlight comes in. I could almost hear some, you know, banjo music in the distance, I guess. And I looked at him, and I said, what the hell are you doing here? And he didn't say a word. He just stuck his hand out, put it right across my chest, and moved me out of the way and called for his sister. And evidently, I chased them out of the house. I ran the driveway down the street screaming. I went back in the house. I called the two people that still answer the phone. I guess told them I was going to kill myself, and then I passed out. Now, by this time, all my dreams have come true. I'm still restless, irritable, and discontent. I still got the pretty girl. I still got the beautiful kids. But now, they don't want nothing to do with me. I had the ministry, I quit that. Everything that I could dream of, that I wanted to do, none of it fixed me. And the professionals told me, you crave chaos. I've been beaten into a state of reasonableness. I didn't know what else to do. My wife's working three jobs at this time. I wake up that night, it's 1 a.m., and I call my wife. She doesn't say hello. Because she's getting off of her third job, and I guess she's gotten some phone calls. And I just hear, what did you do? And I said, I was drinking. And she kind of tore into me, well-deservedly. Now, I can remember I walked into the bathroom, and for the first time ever to myself or to anybody, I looked in that mirror, and I said, I can't stop. I have a problem. My wife had been telling me that she would, if I needed help, she'd help me get it. She came home and I said, I need help. And she just turned over her shoulder. She was walking out of the room. She said, then get it. And I said, oh, well, all that grace is gone. And I did. I sat in a closet all night crying like a baby, Googling phone numbers and calling every number that came up. And every one of them was the same. Well, yeah, we want to help you. What are you drinking? What are you doing? By this time, y'all, it's 20 Norcos a day minimum. and at least a half a gallon of vodka, minimum. Some days much more. So, you know, what are you doing? What, okay, don't stop doing it. Hey, what's your insurance, by the way? I tell them, oh, man, we can't help you. All right, great. Call the next one. And this cycle is just going on. And finally somebody said, yeah, we got a place that'll take you. They'll call you in the morning. Now, what I know now that I didn't know then is all those 800 numbers, they route to the same call center. So I was essentially calling the same people all night for the same reasons. They were very nice. And I don't know why all of a sudden they found a place that could take me, but they did. They said, they're going to call you in the morning. And I said, okay. And so I held on to the morning and they called me and we go through the same thing. And what are you drinking? What are you taking? What are you doing? And they're like, okay, don't stop drinking. So now my wife's had maybe 2 hours of sleep. She's up getting ready for her first job. I'm sitting in a chair with a phone listening to these people going, She's coming out of the bathroom and I look up and I said, they told me not to quit drinking yet. Guys, you got moms, you got sisters, wives, girlfriends. You ever been around a woman that you pissed off? You know that look? Like if laser beams could shoot out their eyes, they would just instantly vaporize you. Yeah, that's the look I got. And I said, oh, I'm done. I had some pills and I just kind of took those and held on. And I walked into treatment and the first thing I see besides the little place where they got to give me my vitals are those freaking steps on the wall. Now my only experience with AA at this point is that my brother went when we were teenagers because I told you I got to fly under the radar for a long time because of him. He went and it didn't work. That's all I know. AA doesn't work. And I'm reading the steps and I go, admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. Obviously, I'm here, right? I mean, that was a no-brainer for me. Step two, came to believe, oh, I see where this is going. And I read step three and I said, no. I said, no, I've been there, done that. I made the t-shirts and sold them for fundraisers to take kids to youth camp every year. I ain't doing this. I'm out. And so I just, they took my vitals and I'm sitting there and they're bringing people in and they're telling us their war stories. Right, and how much they drank and all that stuff. And what I'm doing is I'm sitting there and I'm going, okay, dude, you can't drink like me, but brother, I want to drink with you. That's what I'm doing during my treatment, right? And they're teaching me cognitive behavior stuff and whatever. And all. Hey, man, I crave chaos. That's all I know, right? I'm not even admitting I'm an alcoholic yet, but I'm about to create some major chaos in this treatment center if something doesn't change. And, you know, because I've been sober now a whole 3-4 days, I called my wife and said, hey, what are the kids saying? Because obviously they're all at home having a prayer vigil for me on their knees, thanking God that dad is clean and sober and life's about to get so much different because I've been sober for 4 days. That's not what they're doing. And I couldn't believe that. And as a matter of fact, she wouldn't tell me what the kids were saying. But I've been sober 4 days. Why isn't there a parade? Why aren't people, you know, I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. But I have to remember that for all these kids' lives, all they've been hearing is, I'm sorry, I won't do that anymore. Most of the time, it sounded just like, I'm sorry, I won't do that anymore. So finally, she comes to see me, and I'm like, what are the kids saying? And she goes, I'm going to tell you, but you're not going to like it. I said, okay. She goes, our daughter acts like she doesn't hear me when I bring you up. She just ignores it completely. And she says, and our son, anytime I bring you up to him, he goes, fuck that motherfucker. That still hurts to this day. And if he was here, he'd tell you that's the truth. That did something. I was talking to one of the guys in treatment, and I said, I told them what was going on. Now, by this time, they've all found out that I used to be a pastor and, you know, that kind of stuff. And they actually had brought a guy in that was in ministry that's an alcoholic who had been sober a while. Great guy. I talked to him for an hour. At the end of that hour, he said, well, brother, do you have any questions? I said, yeah, will you be my sponsor? And he goes, oh, man, I'm so busy. You know, I'm back in ministry, and I got this church thing. And now, I should say, through the years, the pastors that I worked with, each one of them at different times, I told you I thought something was wrong with me. And I would go to them and say, something's wrong with me. Can you suggest something or, you know, pray for me or something? And most of the time they blew me off. I had one guy, he kind of pulled his glasses down like this. And he looked over the top. And he said, you have a job to do. Go do it. You'll be fine. So when this guy said, oh, man, I'd love to, but I'm in ministry, I just was like, Dave, I shot the bird because I know you can't see that. Blind Dave's my sponsor. No, I'm just, you know, I'm just saying that's kind of how I was to that guy. So, then they're like, well, we have another guy. Here's his number. I'm like, I'm not calling these people. It's all the same to me. I'm not coming to believe in anything because there's nothing out there. You don't understand. I was Pentecostal. Like, we thought we had there's an old joke, you know, Pentecostal or a Baptist dies and goes to heaven and he's walking around getting a tour from St. Peter and they come to one spot and there's like these yellow lines and it says, quiet, please. And as they walk past, you know, everybody's real quiet and they get to the other side and the Baptist looks at Peter and he goes, Peter says, any questions? He goes, yeah, I just won. What was that quiet zone all about? And Peter goes, oh, that's the Pentecostals. They think they're the only ones here. All right, it's funnier in church. But, you know, we thought we had the market cornered on that stuff. I mean, I used to equate the power of God with volume, right? Because it's loud up in there. You know, we got drums and my very first sermon I preached, I was redlining the soundboard. At the end of that, the pastor that I was working with, he pulled me aside. He goes, hey, man, you got your speaking voice? And whatever that was, and somewhere we've got to find your speaking voice. So I had kind of worked through all that. But you're not going to tell me that I need a spiritual program because I did that. You're not going to tell me that the rest of my life I'm going to go to meetings. Because I used to go to 3 meetings a week. And it was a good message. And sometimes I was the guy giving the message. And I couldn't stay sober. I'm not going to meetings. We're going to figure this out a different way. And so after that, my wife tells me about my kids. I'm there and I tell one of the guys and he goes, maybe it's a test of your faith, Jeff. I said, maybe. Truth is, I didn't have faith in anything. But it did something deep inside. And that night I was laying in my room in the dark looking at the ceiling and I said the simplest prayer that paid the greatest dividend. I was just looking up in the dark and I said, all right, if you're really there, give me a sign. And they started almost immediately. Now, it was just enough to put a crack. I was not ready to buy into no God thing. I wasn't going there again. But one of the things that happened is my sponsor, Blind Dave, he walked in one night. And I heard him talk, and I heard my story come back to me. And I was like, oh, this is the guy. And I ran back in my room and I prayed again and I said, okay, if this is the guy, give me a sign. Cause you know, it's working so far. So, all right, if this is the guy, give me a sign. I come back out and Dave starts talking about his son and it reminds me of my son. And I'm like, this is the guy. And so I asked Dave to be my sponsor and, he said yes. And so we started doing the step work. What time do I need to quit? 10 minutes? All right. See, you give a preacher 5 to 10, I'm taking 10. And I'll go through this quick. So we start doing the steps. Now I go to Dave's to do step 1, 2, and 3 all together. And I went in there. If he's going to tell me about God, I'm going to argue with him. And I can argue on a theological level because I'm a minister. So I go in, we go over step 1. He explains the allergy and the obsession. I understood the obsession before I understood the allergy. Cause I had that. I had that obsession. I know what that was about. The allergy, I was like, okay, so you're telling me if I put it in my body, it creates this craving and the craving. Okay. I'm getting that, but the obsession, I gotcha. Cause it's still like when I was 8 years old, that first drink fixes everything. Cause I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. So we go through and we get to step 2 and Dave says something I'll never forget. He says, Jeff, if there is a God, are you willing to let him reveal himself to you as you work these steps? And I told you I was in there. I could have argued with him on a theological level. I had an argument for everything except that. See, the Catholics told me how to believe in God. The Mormons told me how to believe in God. The Pentecostals told me how to believe in God and taught me the dress code so that he would smile at me. I wasn't going to let somebody else tell me how to believe in God. But nobody ever said, if there is a God, are you willing to let him reveal himself to you as you work these steps? Okay. And then I said, Dave, because, you know, I come from a religious background, I said, Dave, do I have to be a missionary to Africa? And he goes, no, but you have to be a missionary to alcoholics. And he said, but right now what you need to do is work these steps. And so I did. I did the inventory at step 4. I sat with Dave at step 5 and told him all the stuff I didn't want to tell anybody. Now, when I did the third step prayer, it didn't even feel as good as it did back when I was a kid making that old-fashioned altar commitment. I felt something, but nothing major. But step 6, Dave sent me home. I took the big book and I took all the work I did. And I sat, he said, make it an hour, Jeff. If you finish early, just sit there and listen. Because the main part of this program is to get me to tune into a voice that is more powerful than mine that can keep me sane and sober. Came to believe in a power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity. Well, the voices in my head were not keeping me sane. The voices in my head convinced the psychiatrist that I crave chaos. So I need a power greater than myself, right? So that's the part of this. So he's like, just listen. I'm like, okay. So I went through the work, man, and I had done a thorough job, and I finished in like 30 minutes, and I just sat there listening for I don't know what. And I have learned since then that I do hear the voice of God in my head, and most of the time it sounds like Blind Dave. So I'm sitting there in the closet, same closet I made those calls, and I'm just listening and nothing's happening, and I fell asleep. And that's a big deal for me because I didn't sleep a lot when I was younger. Our first house, I had to have my own room because my wife was sick of me getting up and down all the time. But I fell asleep. And when I woke up a couple hours later, y'all, I had never felt such peace. Like those voices in my head were quiet for the first time ever. Like, to this day, and I got to do in step 8 and 9, I made amends. That was not fun. But each one of these steps is to deflate our ego. And as Dave has taught me, the reason for that is because it's like a balloon. When you let the air out of your ego and deflate it, it lets God in. And I'm here to tell you that as a minister, we can inflate our egos and push God completely out too. And stay restless, irritable, and discontent for our whole lives and ministries. And we can live our dreams and still end up in rehab. And still end up in front of a group of people and saying, hi, my name's Jeff and I'm an alcoholic. But I needed something that they couldn't give me in that world. I needed step 10, 11, and 12. I needed to launch out on a course of vigorous action to remove the things that were blocking me from the sunlight of the Spirit. I didn't get that in church. I got have faith, keep praying and coming back, and you're going to be fine. And I was never fine. AA gave me a course of rigorous action. Vigorous action. Rigorous action. They gave me rigorous honesty. And I did all that stuff. Now, and I don't have time to go into all this, but let me just tell you this. That son that hated me, we have a great relationship to this day. Obviously, my wife, she wanted off the roller coaster, but now the ride's kind of smoothed out for 3 years. So I think we're good for at least another couple of days. I got at least another week, right, babe? My daughter, she's not scared to be at home with me anymore. I came here from, we had a meeting at my sponsor's house, but before that, I barbecued for all my in-laws and some of the outlaws. And they came over to the house. You know, for years, I could not be around those people without being loaded. And for 3 years now, I've been able to not only be around them, but I can cook for them, and they can come to my house, and I don't want to kill everybody in the room. And it's because what I found through the big book, what I found in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, was I found this connection to a power that's greater than myself. I call him God because that's how he introduced himself to me, and it looks nothing like what they told me it was going to look like in the Pentecostal church or the Catholic church, the Mormon church. And if you're any of those things, I'm not slamming it. I'm just telling you my story. Right. I've come back to my faith, you know, and I participate but the church I go to now, it meets in a living room, not in a building. So it's a little different. But those voices in my head that kept me drinking, that restless, irritable, and discontentment that kept me going for 30 years is quieted because of the steps Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And it gave me a lot of cool stuff. It gave me my family back. I got jobs. That's how I met Tiffany. I was on disability for 8 years. I got a job. I got to be her boss. I don't know that I asked for that blessing, but no. And we work together now at a different place, so it's been cool. I get to go and speak to groups. I get to work with other guys. I get to carry this message. I get to sit with other guys who maybe they crave chaos. And I get to watch as we go through the steps, as those lights come on and that peace hits them. And it comes at different places at different times for different people. But, you know, it does say that it'll always materialize if we work for them. You know, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I noticed that after every meeting, they would say, keep coming back, it works if you work it. Well, my experience is that I worked these steps. And yes, I got the relationship back with my kids. And yes, I got a great relationship with my wife. And yes, I got a job. I got all of those things. But the biggest thing that I got was what Bill talks about when he says Ebby came to him. He says, I was about to be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which I had not even dreamed. I lived all my dreams. And I ended up in rehab anyway. This existence that I have now, I could have never even dreamed. And it's probably better that way. Because each day I get up, I do exactly what the book tells me to do. I do a nightly inventory. I get up in the morning. I bring God into my day. And I try to do exactly what He asked me to do. It's a simple program. But a price has to be paid. And that's the destruction of our egos. And I had to go through that process. But now it's pretty simple. And when I get too far out of whack, I just call my sponsor. I work with other alcoholics. I do what the book says to do. And now I go to meetings because I want to, not because I have to. The program for me, I found it in this book. My sponsor showed it to me. I thought something was really wrong with me for a lot of years. I took the medical professional's opinion that I was just craving chaos, and I went out and drank for years after that. But I want to thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous because it showed me what to do to clear away a path where I could stand in the sunlight of the Spirit, as the book calls it, and experience God in a way I never thought before. It's an amazing experience, and it's been an amazing journey. And I hope that if you need it, that you do what the book says to do. Get you a sponsor, go through the steps. You don't have to go to Africa and be a missionary, but at some point you may have to come back here and look at all these beautiful people and share your story. And it'll be worth every second of it. God bless y'all.